out because they had no advantage over other yeast cells. Living for 28 divisions was no advantage over those that lived for 24, and, because Sirtuu uses up energy, having more of the protein may have even been a disadvantage. In the lab, however, we don't notice any disadvantage because the yeast are given more sugar than they could possibly ever eat. By adding extra copies of the Sirtuu gene, we gave the yeast cells what evolution failed to provide. If the information theory is correct, that aging is caused by overworked epigenetic signalers responding to cellular insult and damage, it doesn't so much matter where the damage occurs. What matters is that it is being damaged, and that the Sirtuans are rushing all over the place to address that damage, leaving their typical responsibilities and sometimes returning to other places along the genome where they are silencing genes that aren't supposed to be silenced. This is the cellular equivalent of distracting the cellular pianist. To prove that, we needed to break some mouse DNA. It's not hard to intentionally break DNA. You can do it with mechanical shearing, you can do it with chemotherapy, you can do it with X-rays. But we needed to do it with precision, in a way that wouldn't create mutations or impact regions that affect any cellular function. In essence, we needed to attack the wastelands of the genome. To do that, we got our hands on a gene similar to Cas9, the CRISPR gene editing tool from bacteria that cuts DNA at precise places. The enzyme we chose for our experiments comes from a goopy yellow slime mold called Fusarium polycephalum, which literally means many-headed slime. Most scientists believe that this gene, called IPPO1, is a parasite that serves only to copy itself. When it cuts the slime mold genome, another copy of IPPO1 is inserted. It is the epitome of a selfish gene. That's in a slime mold, its native habitat. But when IPPO1 finds itself in a mouse cell, it doesn't have all the slime mold machinery to copy itself. So it floats around and cuts DNA at just a few places in the mouse genome, and there is no copying process. Instead, the cell has no problem pasting the DNA strands back together, leaving no mutations, which is exactly what we were looking for to engage the survival circuit and distract the Sirtuans. DNA editing genes, such as Cas9 and IPPO1, are nature's gifts to science. To create a mouse to test the information theory, we inserted IPPO1 into a circular DNA molecule called a plasmid, along with all the regulatory DNA elements needed to control the gene, and then inserted that DNA into the genome of a mouse embryonic stem cell line we were culturing in plastic dishes in the lab. We then injected the genetically modified stem cells into a 90-cell mouse embryo called a blastocyst, implanted it into a female mouse's uterus, and waited about 20 days for a baby mouse to show up. This all sounds complicated, but it's not. After some training, a college student can do it. It's such a commodity these days, you can even order a mouse out of a catalog or pay a company to make you one to your specifications. See page 6 in the PDF that accompanies this program. The baby mice were born perfectly normal, as expected, since the cutting enzyme was switched off at that stage. We called them affectionately ICE mice, ICE standing for Inducible Changes to the Epigenome. The inducible part of the acronym is vital because there's nothing different about these mice until we feed them a low dose of tamoxifen. This is an estrogen blocker that is normally used to treat human cancers, but in this case, we'd engineered the mouse so that tamoxifen would turn on the IPPO1 gene. The enzyme would go to work, cutting the genome and slightly overwhelming the survival circuit without killing any cells. And since tamoxifen has a half-life of only a couple of days, removing it from the mice's food would turn off the cutting. The mice might have died, they might have grown tumors, or they might have been perfectly fine, no worse off than if they'd received a dental X-ray. Nobody had ever done this before in a mouse, so we didn't know. But if our hypothesis about epigenetic instability and aging was correct, the tamoxifen would work like the potion that Fred and George Weasley used to age themselves in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And it worked, like wizardry it did. During the treatment, the mice were fine, oblivious to the DNA cutting and sirtuin distraction. But a few months later, I got a call from a postdoc who was taking care of our lab's animals while I was on a trip to my lab in Australia. "One of the mice is really sick," she said. "I think we need to put it down." I asked her to text me a photo of the mouse she was talking about. When the photo came over my phone, I couldn't help but laugh. "That's not a sick mouse," I replied. "That's an old mouse." "David," she said, "I think you're mistaken. It says here that it's the sister of these other mice in the cage, and they're perfectly normal." Her confusion was understandable. At 16 months old, a regular lab mouse still has a thick coat of fur, a sturdy tail, a muscular figure, perky ears, and clear eyes. A tamoxifen-triggered ice mouse at the same age has thinning, graying hair, a bent spine, paper-thin ears, and cloudy eyes. Remember, we'd done nothing to change the genome. We'd simply broken the mice's DNA in places where there aren't any genes and forced the cell to paste or ligate them back together. Just to make sure, later we broke the DNA in other places too, with the same results. Those breaks had induced a sirtuin response. When those fixers went to work, their absence from their normal duties and presence on other parts of the genome altered the ways in which lots of genes were being expressed at the wrong time. Those findings were aligned to discoveries being made by Trey Idecker and Kang Zhang at UC San Diego and Steve Horvath at UCLA. Steve's name stuck, and today he's the namesake of the Horvath clock, an accurate way of estimating someone's biological age by measuring thousands of epigenetic marks on the DNA called methylation. We tend to think of aging as something that begins happening to us at midlife, because that's when we start to see significant changes to our bodies. But Horvath's clock begins ticking the moment we are born. Mice have an epigenetic clock too. Were the ice mice older than their siblings? Yes, they were, about 50% older. We'd found life's master clock winder. In another manner of thinking, we'd scratched up the DVD of life about 50% faster than it normally gets scratched. The digital code that is and was the basic blueprint for our mice was the same as it had always been. But the analog machine built to read that code was able to pick up only bits and pieces of the data. Here's the vital takeaway. We could age mice without affecting any of the most commonly assumed causes of aging. We hadn't made their cells mutate. We hadn't touched their telomeres. We hadn't messed with their mitochondria. We hadn't directly exhausted their stem cells. Yet the ice mice were suffering from a loss of body mass, mitochondria, and muscle strength, and an increase in cataracts, arthritis, dementia, bone loss, and frailty. All of the symptoms of aging, the conditions that push mice, like humans, farther toward the precipice of death, were being caused not by mutation, but by the epigenetic changes that come as a result of DNA damage signals. We hadn't given the mice all of those ailments, we had given them aging. And if you can give something, you can take it away. Fruit of the same tree. Like the gnarled hands of giant zombies breaking free of the rocky soil, the ancient bristlecone pine trees of California's White Mountains strike haunting silhouettes against the dewy morning sun. The oldest of these trees have been here since before the pyramids of Egypt were built, before the construction of Stonehenge, and before the last of the woolly mammoths left our world. They have shared this planet with Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and the first Buddha. Standing some 2 miles above sea level, adding fractions of a millimeter of growth to their twisted trunks each year, defying lightning storms and periodic droughts, they are the epitome of perseverance. It's easy to stand in wonder of these great and ancient things. It's easy to be swept away by their might and majesty. It's easy to simply stare at them in awe. But there's another way to view these antediluvian patriarchs, a harder way, but a way in which we should seek to view every living thing on this planet as our teachers. Bristlecones are, after all, our eukaryotic cousins. About half of their genes are close relatives of ours. yet they do not age. Oh, they add years to their lives, thousands upon thousands of them, marked by the nearly microscopic rings hidden in their dense heartwood, which also record in their size, shape, and chemical composition climate events long past, as when the eruption of Krakatoa sent a cloud of ash around the globe in 1883, leaving a fuzzy ring of growth in 1884 and 1885, barely a centimeter from the outer ring of bark that marks our current time. Yet even over the course of many thousands of years, their cells do not appear to have undergone any decline in function. Scientists call this negligible senescence. Indeed, when a team from the Institute of Forest Genetics went looking for signs of cellular aging, studying bristle cones from 23 to 4,713 years old, they came up empty-handed. Between young and old trees, their 2001 study found there were no meaningful differences in the chemical transportation systems, in the rate of shoot growth, in the quality of the pollen they produced, in the size of their seeds, or in the way those seeds germinated. The researchers also looked for deleterious mutations, the sorts of which many scientists at the time expected to be a primary cause of aging. They found none. I expect that if they were to look for epigenetic changes, they would similarly come up empty-handed. Bristle cones are outliers in the biological world, but they are not unique in their defiance of aging. The freshwater polyp, known as Hydra vulgaris, has also evolved to defy senescence. Under the right conditions, these tiny cnidarians have demonstrated a remarkable refusal to age. In the wild, they might live for only a few months, subject to the powers of predation, disease, and desiccation. But in labs around the world, they've been kept alive for upward of 40 years, with no signs that they'll stop there, and indicators of health don't differ significantly between the very young and the very old. A couple of species of jellyfish can completely regenerate from adult body parts, earning them the nickname immortal jellies. Only the elegant moon jelly, Aurelia aurita from the US West Coast, and the centimeter-long Turritopsis dorni from the Mediterranean are currently known to regenerate, but I'm guessing the majority of jellies do. We just need to look. If you separate one of these amazing animals into single cells, the cells jostle around until they form clumps that then assemble back into a complete organism, like the T-1000 cyborg in Terminator 2, most likely resetting their aging clock. Of course, we humans don't want to be mashed into single cells to be immortal. What use is reassembling or spawning if you have no recollection of your present life? We may as well be reincarnated. What matters is what these biological equivalents of F. Scott Fitzgerald's backward-aging Benjamin Button teach us, that cellular age can be fully reset, something I'm convinced we will be able to do one day without losing our wisdom, our memories, or our souls. Though it's not immortal, the Greenland shark, Somniosus microcephalus, is still an impressive animal and far more closely related to us. About the size of a great white, it does not even reach sexual maturity until it is 150 years old. Researchers believe the Arctic Ocean could be home to Greenland sharks that were born before Columbus got lost in the New World. Radiocarbon dating estimated that one very large individual may have lived more than 510 years, at least up until it was caught by scientists so they could measure its age. Whether this shark's cells undergo aging is an open scientific question. Very few biologists had so much as looked at S. microcephalus until the past few years. At the very least, this longest living vertebrate undergoes the process of aging very, very slowly. Evolutionarily speaking, all of these life forms are closer to us than yeast, and just think what we've learned about human aging from that tiny fungus. But it is certainly forgivable to consider the distances between pine trees, hydrozoans, cartilaginous fish and mammals like ourselves on the enormous tree of life and say, no, these things are just too different. What then of another mammal, a warm-blooded milk-producing, live-birth-giving cousin? Back in 2007, Aboriginal hunters in Alaska caught a bowhead whale that, when butchered, was found to have the head of an old harpoon embedded in its blubber. The weapon, historians would later determine, had been manufactured in the late 1800s, and they estimated the whale's age at about 130. That discovery sparked a new scientific interest in Baleena mysticetus, and later research, employing an age-determining method that measures the levels of aspartic acid in the lens of a whale's eye, estimated that one bowhead was 211 years old when it was killed by native whalers. That bowheads have been selected for exceptional longevity among mammals should perhaps not be surprising. They have few predators and can afford to build a long-lived body and breed slowly. Most likely, they maintain their survival program on high alert, repairing cells while maintaining a stable epigenome, thereby making sure the symphony of the cells plays on for centuries. Can these long-lived species teach us how to live healthier and for longer? In terms of their looks and habitats, pine trees, jellyfish, and whales are certainly very different from humans. But in other ways, we're very similar. Consider the bowheads. Like us, they are complex, social, communicative, and conscious mammals. We share 12,787 known genes, including some interesting variants in a gene known as FOXO3. Also known as DAF16, this gene was first identified as a longevity gene in roundworms by University of California at San Francisco researcher Cynthia Kenyon. She found it to be essential for defects in the insulin hormone pathway to double worm lifespan. Playing an integral role in the survival circuit, DAF16 encodes a small transcription factor protein that latches onto the DNA sequence TTG-TTTAC and works with sirtuins to increase cellular survival when times are tough. In mammals, there are four DAF16 genes called FOXO1, FOXO3, FOXO4, and FOXO6. If you suspect that we scientists sometimes intentionally complicate matters, you'd be right, but not in this case. Genes in the same gene family have ended up with different names because they were named before DNA sequences were easily deciphered. It's similar to the not uncommon situation in which people have their genome analyzed and learn that they have a sibling on the other side of town. DAF16 is an acronym for Dauer Larvae Formation. In German, Dauer means long-lasting, and this is actually relevant to this story. Turns out, worms become Dauer when they are starved or crowded, hunkering down until times improve. Mutations that activate DAF16 extend lifespan by turning on the worm defense program even when times are good. I first encountered FOXO/DAF16 in yeast, where it is known as MSN2, which stands for multi-copy suppressor of SNF1, AMPK, epigenetic regulator. Like DAF16, MSN2's job in yeast is to turn on genes that push cells away from cell death and towards stress resistance. We discovered that when calories are restricted, MSN2 extends yeast lifespan by turning up genes that recycle NAD, thereby giving the sirtuins a boost. Hidden within the sometimes Byzantine way scientists talk about science are several repeating themes: low-energy sensors, SNF1 AMPK, transcription factors, MSN2, DAF16, FOXO, NAD and sirtuins, stress resistance, and longevity. This is no coincidence. These are all key parts of the ancient survival circuit. But what about FOXO genes in humans? Certain variants called FOXO3 have been found in human communities in which people are known to enjoy both longer lifespans and health spans, such as the people of China's Red River Basin. These FOXO3 variants likely turn on the body's defenses against diseases and aging, not just when times are tough, but throughout life. If you've had your genome analyzed, you can check if you have any of the known variations of FOXO3 that are associated with a long life. For example, having a C instead of a T variant at position RS2764264 is associated with longer life. Two of our children, Alex and Natalie, inherited two C's at this position, one from Sandra and one from me, so all other genes being equal, and as long as they don't live terribly negative lifestyles, they should have greater odds of reaching age 95 than I do with my one C and one T, and substantially greater than someone with two T's. It's worth pausing to consider how remarkable it is we find essentially the same longevity genes in every organism on the planet: trees, yeast, worms, whales, and humans. All living creatures come from the same place in primordium that we do. when we look through a microscope, we're all made of the same stuff. We all share the survival circuit, a protective cellular network that helps us when times are tough. This same network is our downfall. Severe types of damage, such as broken strands of DNA, cannot be avoided. They overwork the survival circuit and change cellular identity. We're all subject to epigenetic noise that should, under the information theory of aging, cause aging. Yet different organisms age at very different rates, and sometimes it appears they do not age at all. What allows a whale to keep the survival circuit on without disrupting the epigenetic symphony? If the piano player's skills are lost, how is it possible for a jellyfish to restore her ability? These are the questions that have been guiding my thoughts as I have considered where our research is headed. What might seem like fanciful ideas or concepts straight out of science fiction are firmly rooted in research. Moreover, they are supported by the knowledge that some of our close relatives have figured out a workaround to aging. And if they can, we can too. The landscape of our lives. Before most people could even fathom the idea of mapping our genome, before we had the technology to map a cell's entire epigenome and understand how it bundles DNA to turn genes on and off, the developmental biologist Conrad Waddington was already thinking deeper. In 1957, the professor of genetics from the University of Edinburgh was trying to understand how an early embryo could possibly be transformed from a collection of undifferentiated cells, each one exactly like the next and with the exact same DNA, to the thousands of different cell types in the human body. Perhaps not coincidentally, Waddington's ponderings came in the dawning years of the digital revolution, at the same time that Grace Hopper, the mother of computer programming, was laying the foundation for the first widely used computer language, COBOL. In essence, what Waddington was seeking to ascertain was how cells, all running on the same code, could possibly produce different programs. There had to be something more than genetics at play, a program that controlled the code. Waddington conceived of an epigenetic landscape, a three-dimensional relief map that represents the dynamic world in which our genes exist. More than half a century later, Waddington's landscape remains a useful metaphor to understand why we age. On the Waddington map, an embryonic stem cell is represented by a marble at the top of a mountain peak. During embryonic development, the marble rolls down the hill and comes to rest in one of hundreds of different valleys, each representing a different possible cell type in the body. This is called differentiation. The epigenome guides the marbles, but it also acts as gravity after the cells come to rest, ensuring that they don't move back up the slope or hop over into another valley. The final resting place is known as the cell's fate. We used to think this was a one-way street, an irreversible path. But in biology, there's no such thing as fate. In the last decade, we've learned that the marbles in the Waddington landscape aren't fixed. They have a terrible tendency to move around over time. See page 7 in the PDF. At the molecular level, what's really going on as the marble rolls down the slope is that different genes are being switched on and off, guided by transcription factors, sirtuins, and other enzymes, such as DNA methyltransferases, DNMTs, and histone methyltransferases, HMTs, which mark the DNA and its packing proteins with chemical tags that instruct the cell and its descendants to behave in a certain way. What's not generally appreciated, even in scientific circles, is how important the stability of this information is for our long-term health. You see, epigenetics was long the purview of scientists who study the very beginnings of life, not folks like me who are studying the other end of things. Once a marble has settled in Waddington's landscape, it tends to stay there. If all goes well with fertilization, the embryo develops into a fetus, then a baby, then a toddler, then a teenager, then an adult. Things tend to go well in our youth, but the clock is ticking. Every time there's a radical adjustment to the epigenome, say after DNA damage from the sun or an X-ray, the marbles are jostled. Envision a small earthquake that ever so slightly changes the map. Over time, with repeated earthquakes and erosion of the mountains, the marbles are moved up the sides of the slope toward a new valley. A cell's identity changes. A skin cell starts behaving differently, turning on genes that were shut off in the womb and were meant to stay off. Now it's 90% a skin cell and 10% other cell types, all mixed up, with properties of neurons and kidney cells. The cell becomes inept at the things skin cells must do, such as making hair, keeping the skin supple, and healing when injured. In my lab, we say the cell has X-differentiated. Each cell is succumbing to epigenetic noise. The tissue made up of thousands of cells is becoming a melange, a medley, a miscellaneous set of cells. As you'll recall, the epigenome is inherently unstable because it is analog information, based on an infinite number of possible values, and thus it's difficult to prevent the accumulation of noise and nearly impossible to duplicate without some information loss. The earthquakes are a fact of life. The landscape is always changing. If the epigenome had evolved to be digital rather than analog, the valley walls would be the equivalent of 100 miles high and vertical, and gravity would be super strong, so the marbles could never jump over into a new valley. Cells would never lose their identity. If we were built this way, we could be healthy for thousands of years, perhaps longer. But we are not built this way. Evolution shapes both genomes and epigenomes only enough to ensure sufficient survival, to ensure replacement, and perhaps, if we're lucky, just a little bit more, but not immortality. So our valley walls are only slightly sloped, and gravity isn't that strong. A whale that lives 200 years has probably evolved steeper valley walls, and its cells maintain their identity for twice as long as ours do. Yet even whales don't live forever. I believe the blame lies with M. superstes and the survival circuit. The repeated shuffling of sirtuins and other epigenetic factors away from genes to sites of broken DNA, then back again, while helpful in the short term, is ultimately what causes us to age. Over time, the wrong genes come on at the wrong time and in the wrong place. As we saw in the ice mice, when you disrupt the epigenome by forcing it to deal with DNA breaks, you introduce noise, leading to an erosion of the epigenetic landscape. The mice's bodies turned into chimeras of misguided, malfunctioning cells. That's aging. This loss of information is what leads each of us into a world of heart disease, cancer, pain, frailty, and death. If the loss of analog information is the singular reason why we age, is there anything we can do about it? Can we stabilize the marbles, keeping the valley walls high and the gravity strong? Yes, I can say with confidence that there is. Reversal comes of age. Regular exercise is a commitment, says Benjamin Levine, a professor at the University of Texas. But I tell people to think of exercise as part of personal hygiene, like brushing their teeth. It should be something we do as a matter of course to keep ourselves healthy. I'm sure he's right. Most people would exercise a lot more if going to the gym were as easy as brushing their teeth. Perhaps one day it will be. Experiments in my lab indicate it is possible. David, we've got a problem, a postdoctoral researcher named Michael Bonkowski told me one morning in the fall of 2017 when I arrived at the lab. That's seldom a good way to start the day. Okay, I said, taking a deep breath and preparing for the worst. What is it? The mice, Bonkowski said. They won't stop running. The mice he was talking about were 20 months old. That's roughly the equivalent of a 65-year-old human. We had been feeding them a molecule intended to boost the levels of NAD, which we believed would increase the activity of sirtuins. If the mice were developing a running addiction, that would be a very good sign. But how can that be a problem? I said. That's great news. Well, he said, it would be if not for the fact that they've broken our treadmill. As it turned out, the treadmill tracking program had been set up to record a mouse running for only up to 3 kilometers. Once the old mice got to that point, the treadmill shut down. We're going to have to start the experiment again, Bonkowski said. It took a few moments for that to sink in. 1,000 meters is a good long run for a mouse. 2,000 meters, 5 times around a standard running track, would be a substantial run for a young mouse. but there's a reason why the program was set to 3 kilometers. Mice simply don't run that far. Yet these elderly mice were running ultramarathons. Why? One of our key findings in a study we published in 2018 was that when treated with an NAD-boosting molecule that activated the SIRT1 enzyme, the elderly mice's endothelial cells, which lined the blood vessels, were pushing their way into areas of the muscle that weren't getting very much blood flow. New tiny blood vessels, capillaries, were formed, supplying badly needed oxygen, removing lactic acid and toxic metabolites from muscles, and reversing one of the most significant causes of frailty in mice and in humans. That was how these old mice suddenly became such mighty marathoners. Because the sirtuins had been activated, the mice's epigenomes were becoming more stable. The valley walls were growing higher. Gravity was growing stronger. And Waddington's marbles were being pushed back to where they belonged. The lining of the capillaries was responding as if the mice were exercised. It was an exercise mimetic, the first of its kind, and a sure sign that some aspects of age reversal are possible. We still don't know everything about why this happens. We don't know what sorts of molecules will work best for activating sirtuins or in what doses. Hundreds of different NAD precursors have been synthesized, and there are clinical trials in progress to answer that question and more. But that doesn't mean we need to wait to take advantage of all that we've learned about engaging the epigenetic survival circuit and living longer and healthier lives. We don't need to wait to take advantage of the information theory of aging. There are steps we can take right now to live much longer and much healthier lives. There are things we can do to slow, stop, and even reverse aspects of aging. But before we talk about what steps we might take to combat aging, before I can explain the science-backed interventions that have the greatest promise for fundamentally changing the way we think about growing old, before we even begin to talk about the treatments and therapies that will be game changers for our species, we need to answer one very important question. Should we?
Okay, so what did you want to talk about next?
One of the things people don't often realize is that when you're writing a book, the text of the book gets frozen anywhere from 6 months to a year before the book hits bookstores. But science doesn't stop. And I was wondering if during this process it ever felt frustrating to you that there was this hard deadline and that you knew that the science was going to continue after it.
It was terribly difficult for not just me, but for you and the editors. We were adding new facts as we were going along. In fact, this is one of the few science books that I've ever read that has such up-to-date science that even most of the scientific world hasn't read it yet. And there were even cases where results would come in and I would either forward them to you or we would get on the phone with a student in my lab and talk about not just what the results were, but what was it like 10 minutes ago to discover such an amazing thing? And that's been beautifully documented by you, Matt, in the book. And I'm so pleased we're able to capture these moments because most people don't know what it's like to make these huge discoveries for the first time.
One of the things that was really ongoing as we were writing this and even as we closed out the writing of it were the experiments that are ongoing with the mice in your lab. In chapter one, you talked about the ice mice and you talked about the marathon mouse. What have you been seeing in the months that have passed since we handed our book over to the editors?
Well, there's a lot. We have new molecules that are even better than, we think, are better than NMN, the molecule that made the mice run so far they broke the treadmill. The other thing that's happened is that the reprogramming work has gone very quickly, so we're making huge advances there.
The theory you've offered is that when you treat mice with these NAD-boosting molecules like NMN, their epigenome becomes more stable. Is there anything in the science, in the past few months since we turned the book in that has made you question that assertion at all?
I hope not, because we've just submitted the work for publication. No, the answer is we've done a lot more detailed work on both the NAD work and the resetting of the cell to be young again. And we've probably got about 15 labs around the world working on this with my lab. And when 15 labs are doing these experiments and finding that they can improve the health of mice and improve vision, no matter who does the experiment, then you start to think that, I start to think that we're onto something really quite profound here.
3. The blind epidemic. It was May 10th, 2010, and London was abuzz. Chelsea Football Club had just won its fourth national championship by devastating Wigan Athletic 8-0 on the final day of Premier League play. Meanwhile, Gordon Brown announced that he would be stepping down as Prime Minister in response to a disastrous parliamentary result for his Labour Party, which had lost more than 90 seats in the previous week's general election. With the eyes of the English sports world on one part of London and the attention of the British political universe on another, the goings-on at Carlton House Terrace were missed by all but the most attentive observers of the President, Council, and Fellows of the Royal Society of London for Improving Natural Knowledge. More simply known as the Royal Society, the world's oldest national scientific organization was established in 1660 to promote and disseminate new science by big thinkers of the day, such as Sir Francis Bacon, the Enlightenment's promulgator of the prolongation of life. Befitting its rich scientific history, the Society has held annual scientific events ever since. Highlights have included lectures by Sir Isaac Newton on gravity, Charles Babbage on his mechanical computer, and Sir Joseph Banks, who had just arrived back from Australia with a bounty of more than 1,000 preserved plants that were all new to science. Even today, in a post-Enlightenment world, most of the events at the Society are fascinating, if not world-changing. But the two-day meeting that commenced in the spring of 2010 was nothing short of that. For gathered together on that Monday and Tuesday was a motley group of researchers who were meeting to discuss an important new science. The gathering had been called by geneticist Dame Linda Partridge, bioanalytics pioneer Janet Thornton, and molecular neuroscientist Gillian Bates, all luminaries in their respective fields. The attendee list was no less impressive. Cynthia Kenyon spoke about her landmark work on a single mutation in the IGF-1 receptor gene that had doubled the lifespan of roundworms by activating DAF16, work that was first suggested by Partridge to be a worm-specific aberration, but soon forced her and other leading researchers to confront long-held beliefs that aging could be controlled by a single gene. Thomas Nystrom from the University of Gothenburg reported his discovery that SIR2 not only is important for genomic and epigenomic stability in yeast, it also prevents oxidized proteins from being passed on to younger daughter cells. Brian Kennedy, a former Gorenti student who was about to assume the presidency of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, explained the ways in which genetic pathways that had been similarly conserved in a diverse array of species were likely to play similar roles in mammalian aging. Andre Bartke from Southern Illinois University, former PhD advisor to Michael Marathon Mouse Bonkowski, talked about how dwarf mice can live up to twice as long as normal mice, a record. Molecular biologist Maria Blasco explained how old mammalian cells are more likely than young cells to lose their identity and become cancerous. And geneticist Nir Barzilai spoke of genetic variants in long-lived humans and his belief that all aging-related diseases can be substantially prevented and human lives can be considerably extended with one relatively easy pharmaceutical intervention. Over the course of those 2 days, 19 presenting scientists from some of the best research institutions in the world moved towards a provocative consensus and began to build a compelling case that would challenge conventional wisdom about human health and disease. Summarizing the meeting for the Society later that fall, the biogerontologist David Gems would write that advances in our understanding of organismal senescence are all leading to a momentous singular conclusion that aging is not an inevitable part of life, but rather a disease process with a broad spectrum of pathological consequences. In this way of thinking, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, and other conditions we commonly associate with getting old are not necessarily diseases themselves, but symptoms of something greater. Or, put more simply and perhaps even more seditiously, aging itself is a disease. The law of human mortality. If the idea that aging is a disease sounds strange to you, you're not alone. Physicians and researchers have been avoiding saying that for a long time. Aging, we've been told, is simply the process of growing old, and growing old has long been seen as an inevitable part of life. We see aging, after all, in nearly everything around us, and in particular, the things around us that look anything like us. The cows and pigs in our farms age. The dogs and cats in our homes do too. The birds in the sky, the fish in the sea, the trees in the forest, the cells in our petri dishes, it always ends the same way. Dust to dust. The connection between death and aging is so strong that the inevitability of the former governed the way we came to define the latter. When European societies first began keeping public death certificates in the 1600s, aging was a respected cause of death. Descriptions such as decrepitude or feebleness due to old age were commonly accepted explanations for death. But according to the 17th century English demographer John Graunt, who wrote Natural and Political Observations Mentioned in a Following Index and Made Upon the Bills of Mortality, so were fright, grief, and vomiting. As we've moved forward in time, we've moved away from blaming death on old age. No one dies anymore from getting old. Over the past century, the Western medical community has come to believe not only that there is always a more immediate cause of death than aging, but that it is imperative to identify that cause. In the past few decades, in fact, we've become rather fussy about this. The World Health Organization's International Classification of Diseases, a list of illnesses, symptoms, and external causes of injury, was launched in 1893 with 161 headings. Today, there are more than 14,000, and in most places where records of death are kept, doctors and public health officials use these codes to record both immediate and underlying causes of disability and death. That, in turn, helps medical leaders and policymakers around the globe make public health decisions. Broadly speaking, the more often a cause shows up on a death certificate, the more attention society gives to fighting it. This is why heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and dementia are major focuses of research and interventionary medical care, while aging is not, even though aging is the greatest cause of all those diseases. Age is sometimes considered an underlying factor at the end of someone's life, but doctors never cite it as an immediate reason for death. Those who do run the risk of raising the ire of bureaucrats, who are prone to send the certificate back to the doctor for further information. Even worse, they are likely to endure the ridicule of their peers. David Gems, the Deputy Director of the Institute of Healthy Aging at University College London, and the same man who wrote the report from the Royal Society meeting on the new science of aging, told Medical Daily in 2015 that the idea that people die of pure aging without pathology is nuts. But this misses the point. Separating aging from disease obfuscates a truth about how we reach the ends of our lives. Though it's certainly important to know why someone fell from a cliff, it's equally important to know what brought that person to the precipice in the first place. Aging brings us to the precipice. Give any of us 100 years or so, and it brings us all there. In 1825, the British actuary Benjamin Gompertz, a learned member of the Royal Society, tried to explain this upward limit with a law of human mortality, essentially a mathematical description of aging. He wrote, "It is possible that death may be the consequence of two generally coexisting causes. The one, chance, without previous disposition to death or deterioration, the other, a deterioration or an increased inability to withstand destruction." The first part of the law says that there is an internal clock that ticks away at random, like the chance a glass at a restaurant will break, essentially a first-order rate reaction similar to radioactive decay, with some glasses lasting far longer than most. The second part says that, as time passes, due to an unknown runaway process, humans experience an exponential increase in their probability of death. By adding these two components together, Gompertz could accurately predict deaths due to aging. The number of people alive after 50 drops precipitously, but there is a tail at the end where some lucky people remain alive beyond what you'd expect. His equations made his relatives, Sir Moses Montefiore and Nathan Mayer Rothschild, owners of the Allianz Insurance Company, a lot of money. What Gompertz could not have known, but would have appreciated, is that most organisms obey his law. Flies, roundworms, mice, even yeast cells. For larger organisms, we don't know exactly what the two clocks are, but we do know in yeast cells. The chance clock is the formation of an RDNA circle, and the exponential clock is the replication and exponential increase in the numbers of RDNA circles, with the resulting movement of SIRTU away from the silent mating type genes that causes sterility. Humans are more complicated, but in the 19th century, British mortality rates were becoming amenable to simple mathematical modelling because they were increasingly avoiding not-from-aging deaths, childbirth, accidents, and infections. This increasingly revealed the underlying and exponential incidence of death due to internal clocks as being the same as it ever was. During those times, the probability of dying doubled every 8 years, an equation that left very little room for survivors after the age of 100. That cap has generally held true ever since, even as the global average life expectancy jumped 20 years between 1960 and today. That's because all that doubling adds up quickly. So even though most people who live in developed nations can now feel confident that they will make it to 80, these days the chances that any of us will reach a century is just 3 in 100. Getting to 115 is a 1 in 100 million proposition, and reaching 130 is a mathematical improbability of the highest order. At least it is right now. The mortal breeze. Back in the mid-1990s, when I was pursuing my PhD at Australia's University of New South Wales, my mother, Diana, was found to have a tumour the size of an orange in her left lung. As she was a lifelong smoker, I'd suspected it was coming. It was the one thing we had argued about more than anything else. When I was a young boy, I used to steal her cigarettes and hide them. It infuriated her. The fact that she didn't respond to my pleas to stop smoking infuriated me too. "I've lived a good life. The rest is a bonus," she would say to me in her early 40s. "Do you know how lucky you are to have been born? You're throwing your life away. I won't come visit you in hospital when you get cancer," I would say. When the cancer finally arrived about a decade later, I wasn't angry. Tragedy has a way of vanquishing anger. I drove to the hospital, determined to solve any problem. My mother was responsible for her own actions, but she was also a victim of an unscrupulous industry. Tobacco alone doesn't kill people. It's the combination of tobacco, genetics, and time that most often leads to death. She was diagnosed with cancer at the age of 50. That's 21 years earlier than the first diagnosis in the average lung cancer patient. It's also how old I am now. In one way of thinking, my mother was unfortunate to develop cancer at such a young age. After her back was opened up, rows of ribs were cut from her spine, and major arteries were rerouted, she lived the rest of her life with just one lung, which certainly impacted her quality of life and ensured that she had only a few years of good life left. On the genetics front, my mother was also unfortunate. Everyone in my family, from my grandmother to my youngest son, has had their genes analyzed by one of the companies that offer these services. When my mother had hers done, she learned, albeit after she had cancer, that she had inherited a mutation in the SERPINA1 gene, which is implicated in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or emphysema. That meant her clock was ticking even faster. After her left lung was removed, her right lung was the sole provider of oxygen, but the deficiency in SERPINA1 meant that white blood cells attacked her remaining lung, destroying the tissue as if it were an invader. Eventually, the lung gave out. In another way of thinking, though, my mother was very lucky. She had the come-to-God moment that many smokers need to go to battle with the tremendously powerful forces of addiction in time to save herself, and she spent another 2 decades on this planet. She traveled the world, visiting 18 different countries. She met her grandchildren. She saw me give a TED talk at the Sydney Opera House. For this, we must certainly credit the doctors who removed her cancerous lung, but we should also acknowledge the positive impact of her age. One of the best ways to predict whether someone will survive a disease, after all, is to take a look at how old he or she is when diagnosed. And my mother was, relatively speaking, very young. This is key. We know that smoking accelerates the aging clock and makes you more likely to die than a non-smoker, 15 years earlier on average. So we have fought it with public health campaigns, class action lawsuits, taxes on tobacco products, and legislation. We know that cancer makes you more likely to die, and we've fought it with billions of dollars worth of research aimed at ending it once and for all. We know that aging makes you more likely to die too, but we've accepted it as part of life. It's also worth noting that even before my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, indeed, even before the cancerous cells in her lungs began growing out of control, she was aging. And in that way, of course, she was hardly unique. We know that the process of aging begins long before we notice it, and with the unfortunate exceptions of those whose lives are taken by the early onset of a hereditary ailment or a deadly pathogen, most people begin to experience at least some of the effects of aging long before they're impacted by the accumulation of diseases we commonly associate with growing old. At the molecular level, this starts to happen at a time in our lives that many of us still look and feel young. Girls who go through puberty earlier than normal, for example, have an accelerated epigenetic clock. At that age, we can't hear the mistakes of the concert pianist, but they are there, even as a teenager. In our 40s and 50s, we don't often think about what it feels like to grow old. When I give talks about my research, sometimes I bring an age suit and ask a young volunteer to wear it. A neck brace reduces mobility in the neck, lead-lined jackets and wraps all over the body simulate weak muscles, earplugs reduce hearing, and ski goggles simulate cataracts. After a few minutes of walking around in the suit, the test subject is very relieved to take it off, and fortunately can do so. Imagine wearing it for a decade, I say. To put yourself into an aged mindset, try this little experiment. Using your non-dominant hand, write your name, address, and phone number while circling your opposite foot counterclockwise. That's a rough approximation of what it feels like. Different functions peak at different times for different people, but physical fitness in general begins to decline in our 20s and 30s. Men who run middle-distance races, for instance, are fastest around the age of 25, no matter how hard they train after that. The best female marathoners can stay competitive well into their late 20s and early 30s, but their times begin to rise quickly after 40. Occasionally, exceptionally fit outliers, such as National Football League quarterback Tom Brady, National Women's Soccer League defender Christy Pierce, Major League Baseball outfielder Ichiro Suzuki, and tennis legend Martina Navratilova, demonstrate that professional athletes can stay competitive into their 40s, but almost no one remains at the highest levels of these or most other professional sports much past their mid-40s. Even someone as resilient as Navratilova peaked when she was in her early 20s through her early 30s. There are some simple tests to determine how biologically old you probably are. The number of push-ups you can do is a good indicator. If you're over 45 and you can do more than 20, you're doing well. The other test of age is the sitting rising test, SRT. Sit on the floor, barefooted with legs crossed. Lean forward quickly and see if you can get up in one move. A young person can. A middle-aged person typically needs to push off with one of their hands. An elderly person often needs to get onto one knee. A study of people 51 to 80 years found that 157 out of 159 people who passed away in 75 months had received less than perfect SRT scores. Physical changes happen to everyone. Our skin wrinkles, our hair grays, our joints ache. We start groaning when we get up. We begin to lose resilience, not just to diseases, but to all of life's bumps and bruises. Fortunately, a hip fracture for a teenager is a very rare event that nearly everyone is expected to bounce back from. At 50, such an injury could be a life-altering event, but generally not a fatal one. It's not long after that, though, that the risk factor for people who suffer a broken hip becomes terrifyingly high. Some reports show that up to half of those over the age of 65 who suffer a hip fracture will die within 6 months. And those who survive often live the rest of their lives in pain and with limited mobility. At 88, my grandmother Vera tripped on a rumpled carpet and broke her upper femur. During surgery to repair the damage, her heart stopped on the operating table. Though she survived, her brain had been starved for oxygen. She never walked again and died a few years later. Wounds also heal much more slowly with age, a phenomenon first scientifically studied during World War I by the French biophysicist Pierre Lecomte de Nouy, who noted a difference in the rate of healing between younger and older wounded soldiers. We can see this in even starker relief when we look at the differences in the way children and the elderly heal from wounds. When a child gets a cut on her foot, a non-infected wound will heal quite quickly. The only medicine most kids need when they get hurt like this is a kiss, a band-aid, and some assurance that everything will be okay. For an elderly person, a foot injury is not just painful, but dangerous. For older diabetics in particular, a small wound can be deadly. The 5-year mortality rate for a foot ulcer in a diabetic is greater than 50%. That's higher than the death rates for many kinds of cancer. Chronic foot wounds, by the way, are not rare. We just don't hear much about them. They almost always begin with seemingly benign rubbing on increasingly numb and fragile soles. But not always. My friend David Armstrong at the University of Southern California, a passionate advocate for increasing our focus on preventing diabetic foot injuries, often tells the story of one of his patients who had a nail stuck in his foot for 4 days. The patient noticed it only because he wondered where the tapping sound on the floor was coming from. Small and large diabetic foot wounds rarely heal. They can look as though someone has taken an apple corer to the balls of both feet. The body doesn't have enough blood flow and cell regeneration capacity, and bacteria thrive in this meaty, moist environment. Right now, 40 million people, bedridden and waiting for death, are living this nightmare. There is almost nothing that can be done for them except to cut back the dead and dying tissue, then cut some more, and then some more. From there, robbed of upright mobility, misery is your bedfellow, and thankfully death is nigh. In the United States alone, each year, 82,000 elderly people have a limb amputated. That's 10 every hour. All this pain, all this cost, comes from relatively minor initial injuries, foot wounds. The older we get, the less it takes for an injury or illness to drive us to our deaths. We are pushed closer and closer to the precipice until it takes nothing more than a gentle wind to send us over. This is the very definition of frailty. If hepatitis, kidney disease, or melanoma did the sorts of things to us that aging does, we would put those diseases on a list of the deadliest illnesses in the world. Instead, scientists call what happens to us a loss of resilience, and we generally have accepted it as part of the human condition. There is nothing more dangerous to us than age. Yet we have conceded its power over us, and we have turned our fight for better health in other directions. Whack-a-mole medicine. There are 3 large hospitals within a few minutes' walk of my office: Brigham and Women's Hospital, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and Boston Children's Hospital are focused on different patient populations and medical specialties, but they're all set up the same way. If we were to take a walk into the lobby of Brigham and Women's and head over to the sign by the elevator, we'd get a lay of this nearly universal medical landscape. On the first floor is wound care, second floor orthopedics, third floor gynecology and obstetrics, fourth floor pulmonary care. At Boston Children's, the different medical specialties are similarly separated, though they are labeled in a way more befitting the young patients at this amazing hospital. Follow the signs with the boats for psychiatry. The flowers will take you to the Cystic Fibrosis Center. The fish will get you to immunology. And now, over to Beth Israel. This way to the cancer center. That way to dermatology. Over here for infectious diseases. The research centers that surround these 3 hospitals are set up in much the same way. In one lab, you'll find researchers working to cure cancer. In another, they're fighting diabetes. In yet another, they're working on heart disease. Sure, there are geriatricians, but they almost always take care of the already sick, 30 years too late. They treat the aged, not the aging. No wonder so few doctors today are choosing to specialize in this area of medicine. There's a reason why hospitals and research institutions are organized in this way. Most of our modern medical culture has been built to address medical problems one by one, a segregation that owes itself in no small part to our obsession with classifying the specific pathologies leading to death. There was nothing wrong with this setup when it was established hundreds of years ago, and by and large it still works today. But what this approach ignores is that stopping the progression of one disease doesn't make it any less likely that a person will die of another. Sometimes, in fact, the treatment for one disease can be an aggravating factor for another. Chemotherapy can cure some forms of cancer, for instance, but it also makes people's bodies more susceptible to other forms of cancer. And as we've learned in the case of my grandmother Vera, something as seemingly routine as orthopedic surgery can make patients more susceptible to heart failure. Because the stakes are so exceptionally high for the individual patients being treated in these places, a lot of people don't recognize that a battle won on any of these individual fronts won't make much of a difference against the law of human mortality. Surviving cancer or heart disease doesn't substantially increase the average human lifespan, it just decreases the odds of dying of cancer or heart disease. The way doctors treat illnesses today is simple, wrote J. Olshansky, a demographer at the University of Illinois. As soon as the disease appears, attack that disease as if nothing else is present. Beat the disease down, and once you succeed, push the patient out the door until he or she faces the next challenge, then beat that one down. Repeat until failure. The United States spends hundreds of billions of dollars each year fighting cardiovascular disease. But if we could stop all cardiovascular disease, every single case, all at once, we wouldn't add many years to the average lifespan. The gain would be just 1.5 years. The same is true for cancer. Stopping all forms of that scourge would give us just 2.1 more years of life on average, because all other causes of death still increase exponentially. We're still aging, after all. See page 8 in the PDF. Aging in its final stages is nothing like a bushwalk, where a bit of rest, a drink of water, a nutritional bar and some fresh socks can get you another dozen miles before sunset. It's more like a fast sprint over an ever higher and ever closer set of hurdles. One of those hurdles will eventually send you for a tumble. And once you've fallen one time, if you do get up, the odds of falling again just keep getting higher. Take away one hurdle, and the path forward is really no less precarious. That's why the current solutions, which are focused on curing individual diseases, are both very expensive and very ineffective when it comes to making big advances in prolonging our health spans. What we need are medicines that knock down all the hurdles. Thanks to statins, triple bypass surgeries, defibrillators, transplants, and other medical interventions, our hearts are staying alive longer than ever. But we haven't been nearly so attentive to our other organs, including the most important one of all, our brains. The result is that more of us are spending more years suffering from brain-related maladies, such as dementia. Eileen Crimmins, who studies health, mortality, and global aging at the University of Southern California, has observed that even though average lifespans in the United States have increased in recent decades, our health spans have not kept up. We have reduced mortality more than we have prevented morbidity, she wrote in 2015. So prevalent is the combined problem of early mortality and morbidity that there is a statistic for it, the Disability Adjusted Life Year, or DALY, which measures the years of life lost from both premature death and poor state of health. The Russian DALY is the highest in Europe, with 25 lost years of healthy life per person. In Israel, it's an impressive 10 years. In the United States, the number is a dismal 23. The average age of death can vary rather significantly over time and is affected by many factors, including the prevalence of obesity, sedentary lifestyles, and drug overdoses. Similarly, the very idea of poor health is both subjective and measured differently from place to place, and so researchers are divided on whether the DALY is rising or declining in the United States. But even the more optimistic assessments suggest that the numbers have largely been static in recent years. To me, that in itself is an indictment of the US system. Like other advanced countries, we should be making tremendous progress towards reducing the DALY and other measures of morbidity. Yet, at best, it seems we're treading water. We need a new approach. It doesn't take studies and statistics to know what's happening, though. It's all around us, and the older we get, the more obvious it becomes. We get to 50 and begin to notice that we look like our parents, with graying hair and an increasing number of wrinkles. We get to 65 and if we haven't faced some form of disease or disability yet, we consider ourselves fortunate. If we're still around at 80, we are almost guaranteed to be combating an ailment that has made life harder, less comfortable, and less joyful. One study found that